Hello friends, welcome to the show. My name is Tom Broback and my guest today is Taylor Nelson Cook. Taylor coaches at APEC in Fort Worth, Texas, where he works with athletes of all ages, from elementary school kids learning how to run and jump to elite professional athletes refining their craft. I think Taylor has some unique insights in developing his training philosophy and coaching skills that he shares on the podcast. Make sure you give him a follow on social media after you listen to our chat at tnelsoncook19, both on Instagram and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any feedback, please reach out to me on social as well, at Tom Broback. If you have any ideas for future guests or topics, now on to the episode. How did you first get involved in sports performance, training, things like that?
So I got really lucky. So I went and actually played college soccer at UT Tyler. So I just got done playing college soccer. And I had a friend that I played college soccer with that had applied for an internship with APEC. And I was applying for master's programs in England because I always wanted to work with soccer teams and work with teams over there. So while I was applying for master's programs, he goes, "Hey, I'm actually doing this internship at a place called APEC down the road. You should come do it with me." And the summer internship started like 2 weeks later. And I said, "Hey, I don't think I'm going to get in. Like, it's 2 weeks. There's no way." So he's like, just send your resume in. Let them know that I'm the one that told you to come." I said, "Okay." Sent the resume in, had my interview, and they accepted me that day. So I was like, "Oh, all right, I guess I'm in." So my first introduction to sports performance was with APEC.
Wow.
So that's why I said I got super lucky. When I walked in the facility, it is nothing like what we have now. It looks more like probably a regular gym, I would say. Mm-hmm. But what happened is like we had all the 3D movements that we incorporate on the wall. We had all of our locomotions that we have on the wall. So like run, skip, jump, a jop, a hop, all these different type of locomotions exercises on the wall. And immediately I was blown away. And then I did a whole workout. And once I got done with the workout, I was like, this is what athletes need for sports performances. And everybody says it once they come in, "Man, if I would have been training like this whenever I played X, Y, and Z, I'd have been way better." And that's exactly how I felt, because we always do warm up, speed, power, strength in every workout. So we hit a little bit of everything every time. So after that, that's when I was like, I need to be here.
That's when you know you're in the right place, when like the principles of training and the people that you're around are just awesome. And it doesn't matter if you're in a facility that's 400 square feet or 40,000 square feet, like, you know, you're making progress, you know, you're helping people out, and you know, you're giving the best product available. And it seems like you've been there through most of that transition that APEC gone through, from just being a starter to be world known.
Yeah. So that's also the humbling part behind all of it, because my internship summer was our last summer in the old facility. So okay. I got there and I got to see the old facility. Like, it was 85 degrees in the facility in the summer, and we're churning out classes. So we would do a class every 20 minutes. So every 20 minutes they go to a new station. So they do warm up for 20 minutes, speed for 20 minutes, power for 20 minutes, strength for 20 minutes, and then they'd be out the door. 85 degrees in there with roughly 75 athletes in one given hour, every hour throughout the day. So it got hot in there and it was hard. And our track was only 40 yards. So you had to be really creative with how you develop max velocity sprinting and then how you worked in acceleration work at the same time. So, and then we got to our new facility where we had 70 yards worth of track. We had more Kaiser stuff. We had fields outside. So it made things a lot easier.
When you made that transition over, did you see a big change in the types of athletes you're working with, or did you have the same kind of caliber and you just had more space, more toys, more effective means to getting results with your athletes?
So really it was the same type of athlete, because whenever that first facility, when we went to our big facility, that was in Tyler, Texas. So we went from small, maybe 1,000 square feet gym to almost 2,000 square feet. So almost doubled in size, right? And what ended up happening was we didn't even necessarily get more people. It's just what happened was the people we had ended up getting better results because we had more tools to make better decisions. And I'm going to kind of jump ahead, because I know it's something you talked about on here, and it talked about where is it at? It's so all the new gimmicks in sports performance, right? So all the new tools, and there's, I mean, you can measure bar speed. Now you got, I mean, you have med balls that will actually throw and tell you how fast they're throwing. You know, like there's baseballs that will tell you like what your hand grips are. All, I mean, there's every single thing you name it with technology. And in reality, we have all these cool tools. I mean, we have all the Kaiser machines. We got Woodways, ski ergs. I mean, the gimmicks, you name it. But all it ends up being at the end of the day is a tool to make better decisions, right? So all of it at the end of the day is how can I make a better decision for my athlete that I have in front of me right now? But if I get too, one-sided and too dependent on one piece of equipment, I'm not going to end up doing what's best for my athlete. I'm just going to try and fit my athlete to that tool I have instead of my tool to that athlete.
I like that a lot. And I think with technology, you have to make it fairly simple in terms of like, what's the output we're looking for? Like you want a simple number, you want a simple metric that kids can, you know, athletes can understand like, oh, this is mile per hour. This is meter per second. This is something I can tangibly see and get better at, and not have it overcomplicated, spending so much time trying to explain to them, this is what we're going after, like make it simple. And I think that's why, you know, over the last couple of years, it used to be, what's your max squat? What's your max bench? What's your max clean? Because those are simple numbers. It's one number, right? You know, if it's getting bigger or not. But now, can we explain to athletes how fast you're moving, how fast you're accelerating, how fast you're decelerating? Can we make it a simple number for them? And then that technology is more beneficial instead of trying to make overcomplicating things.
Right. Yeah, exactly right. And part of what made me really think about this too was, so we just got a new stat sport system. So we got the Apex stat sport system. Every time we've been doing speed training, we've never had GPS trackers. We've always just used the browser lasers. But now in, I think it was June, it was like June 27th, we got our stat sports equipment. And so we had Sam Ellinger and Patrick there to try them out. And so like I'm watching it live while Bobby's training them, and I could see Sam's doing double the impacts that Patrick's doing, but it's the same workout. Right. And so immediately I said, all right, hey, Sam, I want you to take off your shoes because you're doing, I mean, you're being twice as hard on your body than Patrick is right now. And so as soon as he took his shoes off, the impacts decreased.
Wow.
Right. So can now,
Not to interrupt you, can you explain what StatSport is? I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, so StatSports is just like, it's very similar to McLeod. It's very similar to Catapult.
Right? Gotcha.
Yeah, so it's a GPS tracker. And what it does is it actually will tell you your max velocity for the workout. It'll tell you accelerations, decelerations. It's got different zones for speed. So it can tell you how many times you actually inserted a sprint into that zone. It will tell you total distance. It tells you impacts, which is kind of like what I referenced to. It tells you fatigue index, tells you metabolic distance. So there's a bunch of information that you can pull, right? I mean, I think the simple version was 26 different numbers that you can track in one workout.
Wow.
But once you upload the information, it turns into like 280, right? Oh my gosh. So when I say those 26, I can watch all 26 of those measurements on an iPad live in that moment. So like while they're working out, I had the iPad going so I could see what their speed was whenever we're doing back pedal sprints. I could also see, so we do a thing with our quarterbacks called locomotion throws. So we take our locomotion series that we do, and then we have them throw the football out of that locomotion series, right? So there's different levels of that. But part of that is being, how fast can you do this type of locomotion in this direction and still deliver the ball on point? So I can see how fast they're running and still being able to deliver the ball on point, right? And it's like Patrick has the record in game for running 17 miles per hour and still being able to throw the football for a completion. So I kind of play with Sam. Like Sam can roll out with a cross and front run and still throw the ball like 15.8 or at 15.8 miles per hour. So
that stuff's amazing. And I think for your athletes, I would assume they have better buy-in when there's an objective, you know, this is how fast you're actually running or moving, or this is how much force you're putting in, rather than subjectively you saying, hey, you look slow today. Hey, you look quicker today. Do you find that with athletes?
Oh, 100%. Especially since I got this StatSport system with all the NFL guys, because like I said, the system is meant to help me make decisions. And I can see it with my eyes. I'm like, man, he's moving kind of slow today. I wonder what that is. I say, hey, how much sleep did you get last night? You know, did you do field work yesterday? You know, I can ask all these questions and sometimes it'll be like, yeah, but I'm good. No, I'm fine. But now with the stats boards, I can say, hey, like you're actually using 52% more on your right side than your left side. So what I want you to do is I want you to try and feel that when you're doing this movement. Are you applying more pressure with your right foot during your A skips, your B skips, your power skips for height? And then he'll come, he'll do a set, come back and be like, yeah, like I was getting way higher off the ground with my right than I was my left. Okay, I want you to try and balance that out and create a little more symmetry and see if you can make it more balanced. And then usually they can figure that out.
Is there a metric with StatSports? I just looked it up here on Google. Is there a specific metric that you look at the most and you find most helpful in your training?
So the biggest ones I look at, especially whenever it's live, is I like to look at their speed currently based on the exercise. Like, so I like to see how fast they're moving during the technical drills. Mm-hmm. And then typically what we'll do is we'll do our full speed warm up. We'll do all of our technical work. Then at the end of the technique block, we'll do backwards sprints, right? So backwards sprints help create symmetry front to back, left to right. And then that kind of helps us clean some of that up leading into it. And then after our backwards sprints is when we get into our 10 yard sprints or our drop-ins or anything like that. So I like to see how fast they're moving in the warm-up, right? And typically I'll have guys get into 15, 16 miles per hour once we do a power skip for distance or a speed bound. Then once they get into the backwards sprint, that number will drop a little bit, but I like to see them try and get faster with their backwards sprint, right? So they may run backwards 12 miles per hour, 13 miles per hour, and then hopefully start getting to 15, 16 miles per hour towards the end. And then look at that in relation to their forwards, right? So how fast they're moving forwards.
I just did some backward sprints the other day, like timing them. And the hardest part for me was staying in a straight line. Do you find that a common theme with your athletes when they're first starting out, like learning, hey, this is like a skill we want to train because of X, Y, and Z qualities?
So typically our problem we have is they do a pretty good job staying in a straight line. So We actually, and this kind of helped, we actually started off making them do backward sprints through lasers. And so the lasers would probably be about 2 yards apart.
Sure.
But we still had them. I mean, and we're taking a risk for sure. But I mean, we wanted to see what that number was in relation to their forward sprint, right? Or their 10 yard sprint, their 10 yard drop in backward sprint. The problem we have is guys don't like to extend backwards. So they would almost stay tight and compact. They mm-hmm. wouldn't utilize their upper body for momentum. And then they would take shorter steps instead of like really separating the upper body and then reaching with the lower half. So once the guys can really reach with the lower half, push from the front and reach with the back, and they continue to replicate that, it's whenever they got a lot faster.
I found that as well. At the first one, I tried to like backpedal like a cornerback. I'm like, this isn't the fastest way to do it. Like I'm comfortable with this. This is a movement pattern I'm familiar with, but I don't trust myself to extend, to reach out and to you know, increase those miles per hour. But that's just a skill you got to practice, learn, get comfortable with, and allow that to transfer over to other parts of your training as well.
Yeah.
Rowing back a little bit, you mentioned some barefoot training, and I'm always going to take an opportunity to touch on that. How much of your training with your athletes do you get them out of their shoes, either in socks or barefoot, and exploring those options?
So typically, I mean, probably one time every workout. Some variation, some type of thing. So one of my new favorite tools we have is the Blackboard. So it will help you separate your forefoot from your calcaneus. And it's got a lot of different exercises for it. So we're actually in the process of creating what I want to call like a foot station. So we have a recovery center upstairs and we have a bunch of blackboards. I have one of those rock mats, right? So for sensations on the bottom of the foot and helping stimulate the nerve endings. Mm-hmm. But we also have vibe plates as well. So I want to put the rock mat on the vibe plate. So then that way they can do a whole barefoot warm up before they ever even start the workout. So being able to utilize all that at the beginning and then put their shoes on and then we can warm up. And then typically once we get into strength, guys will start to take their shoes off just to make sure that they're feeling the ground, feeling the pressure from their whole foot. And separate instances in speed, like so on recovery days we have a full barefoot walking sequence that we do. Regen days are typically fall on Wednesdays for our higher level guys. They probably won't wear shoes the whole time. They'll just walk around barefoot. We're lucky enough. We have a sand court outside. So we'll do sand training. We'll do sand training where they walk around outside in the sand. We just have fun with it. Try and find as many different ways to skin the cat.
Will you do any sprints or plyos barefoot?
Yes. A lot of the primer stuff we'll do barefoot at the beginning. Typically, once we start getting into our higher level sprints, like our high velocity sprints, they'll put their shoes back on. But that also depends on how they feel recovery wise. So I'll say this once again, hopefully he doesn't mind me dropping his name. So Sam, whenever he was doing combine training with us, you know, and I've already kind of alluded to this, based on the impact, Sam's really hard on his body, right? He played 4 years of college football at a high level, consistently played, and he's actually been the starter for 8 years because he was the freshman starter at his high school and then the freshman starter at Texas, right? So he's been playing 8 years of football as a starter and consistently playing. So his body, I mean, it's taken some hits, I mean, from a physical term, but also like internally as well. So what we'll do sometimes, if he isn't feeling 100% with his body, I'll have him go barefoot because it kind of puts a limiter on him, because I still want him to get through these ranges of motion and I still want him to apply effort and speed, but he's not going to run full speed barefoot because he'll feel it and it'll hurt, you know, but he's still able to hit the right movements I'd say 80 to 85% without feeling like he's pushing his body too far. So we do that with a lot of different guys. It just, once again, it's part of communication with your athlete and them telling you how they feel and then you knowing the right questions to ask at the right time.
I would think doing that, like get him to go barefoot, is a much better like cue for him than any like verbal thing you could tell him. Like, hey, like slow down. Hey, move this way. It's like, no, let respond the way that your body's telling you right now. And it's limiting you a little bit because of your past history, because of your training history, because of where you're at right now. So it seems like you're being much more efficient and effective with those kind of things rather than just yelling at him the whole session.
Yeah. Well, hey, be lighter on your feet. Like try and be nicer to yourself. Yeah. It makes it super simple. You know, I mean, it makes it super simple.
You work with a variety of athletes, like middle school, high school, collegiate, pro athletes. How do you transition from, you know, talking to a sixth grader all the way up to working with NFL guys? How do you transition both in your coaching, in your communication, in your body language? How do you do that throughout the day?
Yeah, so I've been pretty lucky that this is almost kind of a personal attribute of mine. And that's something that Bobby and Kai, who used to work at APEC, who was our vice president, that was one of the things that they've always kind of noted to me personally, is I'm really lucky that I can change to the group that I'm with, right? And I say that because, you know, I'm not going to talk to an adult, because I train adults as well. I'm not going to talk to an adult who's a grown professional in their industry at 50 years old the same way I'm talking to their 7-year-old kid, right? Mm-hmm. So typically ages 5 through 11, like I want to be their friend, but I'm also their coach and their teacher as well. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's going to be more playful, but if things get out of order, you're going to be able to snap and put everything back in place very fast. Yep. Right. And then making sure that they're following the rules, but still having fun within the same time to make sure that they're following constraints. Typically middle school is always the hardest, right? Because they're at this weird point in their life. They don't really know how their body is. They don't know how their brain is. They're still figuring it all out. So what happens is you almost have to be more humble with them and have more grace with them, but still understand that you are their coach. You are their mentor. You are the person that they're either looking up to or looking to for guidance. So you want to be able to come to them and chat more, say, have conversation. And there's a certain amount of autonomy you have to give them, because we have athletes that come in and they're like, I really don't want to do this today. Mm-hmm. I was up late last night with my friends and I'm not doing this. I'm not running. You know, it's like, hey, I understand you were up late, you know, but today's also a great day to get better, to make sure that you are challenging yourself. You know, you want to make sure you continue to do that every single day, you know, and teach them those values that become core values through their life. And as long as they won't care how much you know until you know how much they care. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's tailored towards our middle school group. That's our middle school group.
100%.
You know what I mean? probably more so than any other group. With high school athletes, we've been really lucky that with our high school athletes, they feel this when they come in the facility. They like training with us because they understand everybody's here for the same goal, right? So typically what happens is athletes that want to come in just to be around big names, they don't end up staying around too long because they realize the work's a lot harder than what they're willing to put in. Right. So the groups that we get, and it has nothing to do with the level of athlete. We have hard workers that are going to be D1 athletes, and we have guys that don't work very hard that are going to be D1 athletes, right? But typically the hard workers that are going to be JUCO, NAIA, D3, D2, D1 high school kids, those hard workers stay because they know that it's worth it and it's beneficial to them no matter what level they play. So
do you find it more challenging to coach younger kids versus older kids?
The age range is probably what, so when you say younger kids, you mean like 5 to 11?
Let's go like middle school versus high school.
Middle school is hands down the hardest group to coach. Mm-hmm. And so this is also kind of a fun fact, alluding back to my early APEC career. So I was a part-time employee for the first year. And so what I would do is my mom made a deal with me. She said, hey, whenever you graduate, I'll buy you a car under $25,000, you know, if you graduate on time. Wow. So I'm the first person in my family to graduate college. So she was like, if you graduate on time, I'll buy a car for you. Right. So what happened was when I graduated, I said, hey, I don't want a new car. I want you to give me that money so that I can pay for rent and pay for food so I can keep working at APEC part-time.
Wow. That's committed. Yes.
Yeah. So then what happened was a year later, I actually started full time and my title was youth development coordinator.
Okay.
So I realized that there was a hole at APEC where, you know, we had people that were in charge of the high school program and people that were in charge of the adult programs. And I said, hey, like there's a huge population here, you know, of youth athletes. And I would love to be the guy that's in charge of that for APEC, you know, and I tell every intern this, APEC is the best job in the world and the worst job in the world because we don't have any job openings. Like we won't put in an ad and say, we have a job opening, right. Come apply. Yep. You have to come make a job. When you do an internship, that is your opportunity to fill a hole that we don't have yet. Right. So we only hire people that have done our internship and they've showed us like, hey, I can grow a program. I can relate to people. I have the qualities needed because anybody can be taught anything. I'm not worried about if you know speed yet because I know that I can teach you that along the way. I just need you to understand basic principles and then also have a great attitude, commitment level, and then make sure that you're doing the things you need to do. So I saw that opportunity as youth development coordinator, and that was my full-time job. So I was in charge of researching and finding out and learning about how to train athletes ages 5 to 11 the best, right? So I say all that alluding to that middle school group, because in that middle school group, you have kids that could probably be in high school and then kids that could probably still be in that 5 to 11 age range. Right.
Oh, sure. Right. Yeah. You get a wide variety.
I had a kid this summer, 6'4", going into eighth grade. And then in that same group, same class going seventh to eighth grade, he was 5'4", plays baseball.
Oh my God. Same gosh. Group. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So what happens is, How do I talk to him? And then how do I talk to the taller kid? And then I have a girl that actually, her mom just messaged me this morning. She made A team at her new school. So she went from a small private school to a high level public school. Mm-hmm. She just made A team for the first time. And then I have another girl in that group that this is her first time ever doing anything related to athletic performance or sports. She wanted to start playing sports and they came to APEC first. Same group, right? So now there's training ages. So now what happens is you actually have to be, by every single definition of the word, a coach with that group. Like, how do I adjust this program for him within the session? How do I adjust this program for her in this session? And then that's also the most rewarding part, because now if someone walks by our window and they look at our middle school program, it's going to look like we have 8 different programs going on. But in reality, what's happened is I've taken this layout and I've modified it for each individual within that group, and it's at a middle school level. So
middle schoolers are pretty smart too. At the high level and the low level, you have to make it harder or easier based on their skill. But middle schoolers will just look like, oh, it's not fair. Like, she has the easier box, or, hey, it's not fair. Like, he has like the lighter weight. But you got a way to make it competitive, make it fair, make it seem like everyone's doing the same work. So the kids are more focused on themselves and not what everyone else is doing. Do you find that too?
100%. And the next thing to it too, is I'm big on laying expectations out early. And that was something I learned from having kids. You know, I have my son's name's Liam, and I'll say, Liam, I don't want you going upstairs. Like, do not go upstairs. So as soon as he goes upstairs, like, I can say, hey, I told you no, now you're in trouble. But what happens is, if I don't ever say to him, I say, hey, I just want you to stay in the house. And then he goes upstairs. He said, why'd you go upstairs? I said, oh, well, I wanted to go play with my toys. I never told him he couldn't go upstairs, so I'm not allowed to get mad at him, right? Mm-hmm. So laying out the expectations early then gives you the ability to come back later and say, hey, these are the rules and expectations I laid out early. You're not meeting those expectations. So it takes the emotion out of it, right? Instead of, hey, I don't want you being upstairs by yourself. So it's the same thing with the middle school athletes. I lay the expectations out early. Usually that first week, I mean, that first week we may do one set of exercises. You know, usually that first week we'll do like a 1x20. Like, hey, we're going to do a body weight squat. We're going to do a hand release push-up. We're going to do a body weight row. And we're doing 1x20. But look, this is exactly what I want you to do. You will rotate in this order, right? And I want you to go from here to here to here. This is the most efficient way to do this, okay? If at any point you don't feel like, you know, you are getting the most, raise your hand and holler at me. I'll be here. You know, if you want a way to challenge yourself because you're ready, let me know, right? But what that way, it kind of creates a checks and balances. Like, coach, this is too easy. What can I do to make it harder? All right, show me a rep. Yeah, you got it. Here's what I want you to do. Move your feet closer. Right. So that way they know to kind of check in with me before they feel like they can level up. But it gives them the autonomy to know that I'm going to let them choose for them. Can I make this harder? Right. And then I continue to walk around and kind of be the general on the floor and say, hey, that's too easy for you. Make it harder. Or, hey, your technique's kind of getting out of whack. I want you to back up a little bit and let's stay here for the rest of the day. And then next week we'll check in. Right. So.
My general philosophy for work for me has always been like, I like structure, but I like freedom within that structure. So like, I want like, to kind of generally know, like, what do I need to do to be successful at this job? But like, I want to make choices within that. And I think you've been able to implement that with the younger kids so they can, they're not running around like goofing off, like doing crazy stuff or getting hurt, but also they feel like they're a part of it. They feel like they have some autonomy. They feel like they can challenge themselves, and that's got to make for just an awesome training environment.
Yeah. And I posted this on my Instagram earlier this summer. So that same middle school group that I had, cause I, like I said, we do rotations. So at the end of the workout, I always get them at strength, and then we always finish. So we'll finish with 10 minutes of conditioning at the end. Right. And typically we stay in an alactic zone, or we'll get into more of an anaerobic area, alactic anaerobic. So I say that because I will let them choose what equipment they want to do their conditioning on, right? So I'll be like, hey, do y'all want to do woodways or VersaClimbers today, right? So I say that because, I mean, no matter what, we're going to do woodway or VersaClimber, right? And I'm focusing on the work to rest ratio. So I'm looking for, you know, I'm looking for 10 seconds on, 50 seconds off. So whenever I choose that exercise on the VersaClimber, I'll say, hey, I want you to aim for 45 steps, because if they get 45 steps, then what happens is they're usually finishing that in about 10 seconds. Mm-hmm. They're off, right? And then I set them up as teams. And if I can get five people in a team, it ends up being a very similar work to rest ratio, but it's a competition and I'm still getting the energy systems that I like. And because it's competition, they're all pushing themselves because they don't want to lose, right? So I can get more bang for my buck in that 10 minutes than if I did 45 minutes of conditioning outside.
100%. And the kids don't even know like what your goals are as the coach, and you don't need to explain to them. Like, they're in, you know, they're 10, 11, 12 years old. Like, they don't care, but you're making it fun, competitive, but also productive, in a fun training environment.
Yeah.
Okay. Diving into a little bit of kind of training specific. So, there's a lot of chatter about, hamstring development. What can we do to get hamstrings stronger? What can we do to get them perform better? What can we do to prevent them from pulling a hamstring? And we see this all the time, especially this year, like with the Olympics, you see athlete pull up, grab their hamstring. Have you had any success in training in developing hamstrings, preventing injuries, things of that nature, whether it's middle school, high school, or even your higher level athletes?
Yeah. So I'm actually going to kind of allude to a time before I was at APEC.
Sure.
Because obviously Bobby started APEC 17 years ago, 2005, 16 years ago in Tyler. Right. So what happened was Bobby started APEC on gravel and grass. Right. So he did speed and agility camps 4 days a week. And then he grew APEC obviously into what it is now. Right. Mm. Along the way, he picked up some people. So he used to have glute ham developers in the facility. And then he went and did a fellowship with Gary Gray. And so Gary Gray talks about chain reaction biomechanics and what happens when your foot hits the ground. So what happens once your foot hits the ground, the action of the hamstring actually changes than when your foot's off the ground, right? So the hamstring flexes the knee, but once your foot hits the ground, it becomes a decelerator and an accelerator. So it's concentrically working and eccentrically working at the same time. And the best way to help develop the hamstring is by making sure that your foot's on the ground, because that's what happens whenever you're sprinting, right? So Bobby ended up throwing away all the glute ham developers, focused more on hamstring development with the foot on the ground. And based on the stories he said, he saw probably about a 75% reduction in hamstring injuries.
Wow.
Right? Just from taking glute hams out. So then from there, of course, he's like, all right, we're on to something. So now I say fast forward into that. So we incorporate, the big thing in the world nowadays, isometrics, velocity-based training, things of that nature, right? So we, once again, trying to use the right tools at the right time, you know, we focus on max speed velocity training or max velocity training on the track, right? And I tweeted this too to somebody, the best thing for hamstring development is max velocity sprinting. The whole reason we needed 70 yards worth of track is so that we could do max velocity sprinting, mm-hmm. right? And so we incorporate that into the training and we focus on that as well within the first part of the workout. Then whenever we get to our power development area, we have VBT. It's kind of a rough variation of VBT. But what happens is then we're training the hamstring to work eccentrically, isometrically, concentrically every time based on the work we're doing. Cause they may do like a Viper lunge and chop where they're having to decelerate and then be able to pull back out, right? But now we do that in all planes of motion. So we'll do like a forward lunge with a Viper chop, angle lunge with a Viper chop, a side lunge with a Viper chop, right? And so now the body and the hips are having to rotate around the femur, around a stable femur. So now that hamstring is having to stabilize in three planes of motion, as well as eccentrically and then concentrically. And then whenever we get to our strength development, that's when we focus more regular RDLs, stiff leg RDLs, we do a lot of hex bar work with more of a posterior side focus, and then a lot of single leg RDLs too. So
have you struggled developing your own philosophy when you're working for a company that has its own kind of philosophy and there's other coaches that they've done different things, they have different experiences? Do you struggle with that at all?
I don't. And once again, this kind of goes back to how I treat middle school. So Bobby's owner, founder, creator of APEC. But what he does a really good job of is he helps find information that's relevant and then teaches us and then allows us to make decisions, right? Because he can't coach. I mean, I think last summer, so from June up until August 20th, yesterday was technically our last day of summer training. Sure. I think it was we had 1,013 athletes across both facilities.
Oh, wow.
So we trained 1,000 athletes from June to August, right? Bobby cannot train all of those people
right.
at one time, right? So what he does is he collects information and continues to educate us and shows us avenues where we can learn as well, right? So I say all that because he provides a framework and then it's our job to fill in that framework, right? So I say all that because I can make changes and adjustments on the fly as needed with individuals with any group I have. Right. And that's because I've built that trust from Bobby and Brandon, who's also our COO, the uppers at the company, to make sure that I'm doing what's best for the athlete. And I tell all the coaches all the time, as long as you are thinking about the athlete and what is best for this athlete, it's going to be hard to make a bad decision because you're doing what's best for them and you're taking the knowledge you have and trying to provide the best option for them at that moment in time. So I get to use my own philosophies and I get to use my own research that I find to kind of use that as well, but it's within a framework.
My brother the other day, he has a similar background as me, physical therapist and strength and conditioning. He's like, I think Bobby's the best social media guy you've sent me or let me know about in the last, you know, 6 months to a year. And I absolutely agree. And the more I dive into like his background, your background, what you guys do at APEC, from a PT standpoint, it makes so much sense because you do care about injury prevention. You do care about the athlete as a human, as like a holistic training model, and not just how much you squat, how much you bench, things of that nature. So it seems like you guys have done a phenomenal job of prioritizing health and wellness, as long as fitness and physical performance as well.
Yeah, that's, we like to feel the same way too.
What are other some unique training, either equipment or philosophies or exercises that you've been able to implement well in your time at APEC?
Man, that's a good one. Once again, I mean, tools on top of tools, right? And I say tools on top of tools because we have Kaiser functional trainers, Kaiser racks, Kaiser power squats. The Kaiser equipment for us, I mean, is game changing just because you get to see what you do every single time. You get to see how much power you're putting out. But then, like I said, we use kind of a loose velocity based system approach, right? So I'll have an athlete put their body weight on the power squat and then do 6 reps as fast as they can, right? I don't have the time to max squat them, figure out what 30% of their max squat is, have them move for a certain amount of reps, right? So I'm looking for adaptations within a framework, right? If I know with a lighter load and then moving fast, it's going to be more on the speed strength side, right? Mm-hmm. We do our pure speed development. Like we'll do granny tosses with 2 pounds, you know, and the whole idea is you get down, you get up as fast as you can, lightweight, moving really fast. We do acceleration work. We do max velocity work. We do change of direction. So I would say just the ability to use all the Kaiser equipment, because we'll do velocity-based training with lunges. We'll do it with rows. We'll do it with parallel rotations, chops, lifts. I mean, we do it with everything, right? So that's why I think the Kaiser equipment is probably the best that I've been able to have.
When you're doing exercises on the Kaiser equipment, are you just comparing their numbers to their previous self, or do you have standards for different athletes, different ages, different exercises of like different metrics that you want them to hit?
So we compare them to themselves, right? Okay. So the number one thing you're ever going to get from a weight room is confidence, right? Preparation breeds confidence. So at the end of the day, the goal when someone comes into APEC is when that they leave, they are more confident, right? Mm-hmm. Always and forever, that'll be the case. So we want them in a group setting and we want them to compete, right? Those that want to compete with their friends in the group, more than welcome. But we also have people that don't really want to compete in the group. So what we do is we'll actually track numbers. We have windows all through APEC. So if you ever come in, like we'll write down everybody's number for a power chop, a power lift, a max effort pull down, a rapid fire vertical jump on the jump mat. Their one step approach jump on the jump mat. We have 1 to 11s. We have miles per hour on speed because we use pocket radars, or we'll have the stats boards. Then we also have, what else? We have push up ISO hold, squat ISO hold. So how long, pretty much a burnout squat ISO, mm-hmm. To see how long they can hold it. And I think we have 18 different numbers that we have all throughout the facility. And then we also, I mean, so we'll put their numbers on the window. So an athlete will come, they'll do an exercise, bang, 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 and go, oh, I think that's a PR. Go over to the window and say, yeah, that's a PR. They'll race the number and put their new number on.
That's just an awesome system, and gets the athlete to, and I've talked about this before with coaches like Tony Holler and JT Ayers, where if you're comparing like your former self, you can always get better. You can always be like the best version of you that day. If you're always comparing yourself to the best athlete in the room or the best athlete in the district or the county or the state, like you might never feel accomplished or gain that confidence. And that's been a big philosophical change for me working with athletes in my PT clinic. Like, hey, like this is where you were yesterday. This is where you are today. Like, we're better. Don't compare yourself to the person across the room, because you have no idea their training history, their injury history, their goals. But we can always get, and as coaches too, I think often it's like, oh man, like, you know, X amount of people listen to this podcast. Like, is that good or bad? It's like, well, the first one you did, like 50 people listen. So you're doing better, you know, or
right.
Hey, I only got to talk to like 3 coaches this month. It's like, well, when you first started, you couldn't no one responded to you. So I think as coaches, we can take that into our own development, career development, and it's more rewarding, and you can win every day because you can always be getting 1% better, 2% better, 3% better, instead of looking at one of your role models and just being depressed. Like, hey, I'm not them. I might never be them. And it's like, that's not a fun way to live life, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely not. And I'm a super competitive person, right? So
sure.
The more I get into the strength conditioning world, the more people I meet that say, I mean, I'm the same way. I'm like, man, like they have this person, they have this person, you know, like, man, I want to train. So I also kind of, this is off topic and on topic. Like, I have a soft spot for all the sports people don't care about. So like I would love, like, so I trained a professional bass fisher and I had a heck of a time with it. It was so much fun.
Oh my right? God. What'd you do with them? Bass fisher. I don't even know what skills you need in that.
So what ends up happening is because you're on the boat and you're on the water, like you're going 80 miles per hour on the boat, right? And you're scooting across the water because you're trying to get from point A to point B.
Oh,
on the lake.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what happens is she's barefoot the whole time while she does it. But then because of the boat, she's having to bounce up and down. So she's taking impact like this over and over again.
Okay.
Right. And then whenever she first came to me, it was because she had thoracic outlet syndrome. She had just had surgery for TOS. So she was trying to rehab from TOS, but still be able to fish. So now, once again, all right, now you just gave me my parameters. Okay. She's taking a lot of impact. How can I decrease the impact? How can I prepare her body for that impact to feel better? Right. Because the idea is it's more about making her feel good when she's fishing. I don't want, if she's always like, man, my back hurts, like, instead of focusing on what she has to do. So that one's a blast. I had a pro volleyball player. So the first ever professional volleyball league that was held in Dallas, actually went from Nashville to Dallas. She played at UCLA. She played professional volleyball overseas. So she had a kid and she reached out because she said, I'm 9 months postpartum, but I want to play professional volleyball again. And I was like, bet. Yes, I'll train you. I love it. So I like having those challenges, and that's exciting for me. So having all those different sports, and I have a soft spot for all the sports that people don't really pay attention to.
Do you get super excited watching the Olympics then? You see all these different sports that not everyone knows about. And then also you can like see it from a sports performance lens, like, oh, like this is how they rotate, this is how they're applying force, this is their shin angle. Is that your kind of jam too?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, so for sure. Like, so curling, badminton. Oh my gosh. Like I, once again, I'm like, I would just love to have one curling guy that I could train, or a team of curling guys that I could train. Like,
hey, come up to Minnesota. We got a bunch of curling up here.
See, hockey. So I've never had a hockey player. I'm in Texas. Right. So
yeah,
hockey, they've like high schools will partner with other high schools to create a hockey team because they can't get enough from one school. Right. And it's like, I grew up watching the Dallas Stars. Like, I mean, I remember in 1999 when they won the Stanley Cup, I was up all night watching it, you know, and I was 8 years old. So it's like, I have one of those, man, I would just love to have a hockey player. I'd love to get a hockey player.
Hey, we got plenty of those too.
That's it.
So you're just living in the wrong state, it sounds like. Going forward, looking to the future of sports performance, what do you see either like in your career of what's going to be valuable, or working with athletes? What kind of technology, what kind of training philosophies, what things do you think are going to be the most important in the coming 3 to 5 years?
So there's already kind of been a pretty decent switch now. Speed training. Speed is... Speed is the adaptation you're looking for that lifts all boats, right? Mm-hmm. So I say adaptation because even when you're doing speed development on a track, right, what I'm trying to, I mean, outside of throwing a baseball, max velocity sprinting is one of the shortest contacts you're going to have, right? So how fast the shoulder moves and then how fast the body has to move from takeoff, you know, to stance. It's one of the hardest things to do. It takes a high level of technique. But what's going to happen is there's been a lot of people in the world that say you can't coach speed, right? And I completely disagree with that. You know, that they're either genetically gifted or they're not. Well, based on what we know, you know, you can train the technique side and then give them those reps to get faster. And then whenever we come over to power development, in power development, our goal is to help make you faster, right? So the more power you produce, right, the more distance you're going to be able to get off the line whenever you start your sprint, the more hit separation you're going to be able to have to cover more ground. Then whenever we get to strength for us is more about stability for the structure, right? Mm-hmm. And we have a whole list of exercises that once you hit a certain, like 2 times your body weight on deadlift, it's like 1.5 times your body weight on bench, two times your chop on a lift, or two times your lift on a chop, right? So if you can do 40 PSI on a lift, we want you to be able to do 80 PSI on a chop, right? Sure. So that becomes relative to what they can do, right? And then we're looking for, so we use the Kaisers for anti-rotation. So I want you to be able to do anti-rotation with at least 50 PSI, 3 reps on each side, and then be able to produce at least 2000 watts of power with a push pull. Right. So we have a whole measurement system now. Okay. Once you get to this point, like you have that adaptation. Now we just have to maintain it. Now we need to go to your next weakest link. If you can't deadlift two times your body weight, like that's a KPI for you. We need to hit that. Once you hit that, okay, now we got to move on to something else. Right. And then we just maintain that. So
as a coach, it's really easy to say, like, we need to fill each of these buckets. And I think that's a great way to view coaching and view athletic development. As an athlete, I think it's really hard to want to focus on things you're not so much good at. Some competitive athletes are great at that, but some athletes, they just want to do what they're good at. Do you find that kids struggle buying into, hey, I need to work on XYZ, these things I'm not as good at, but if I get better at, I'll be a better overall athlete?
Yeah, we have some. We have some that obviously guys that want to come in, like every year there'll be a guy that, I mean, we had a middle school athlete say, How come I'm not doing power cleans? Like, how come I can't just do power cleans? You know, they say, when are we going to back squat? And I'll go, okay, so do you work out at school? And he goes, yeah. I said, what do you do at school? Well, usually we'll back squat and we'll do bench. I said, so if you're already getting that, why do we need to do it here?
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, okay. the other story I like to share with an athlete is I'll tell them about Jimmer Fredette. So I read a story about Jimmer Fredette. I don't know if people really know who he is anymore because he kind of fizzled out of the league.
I was a big Jimmer guy. I was in college when he was going off. So
yeah,
I had a quick rant here, or a tangent, I should say. I had a buddy, he went to some conference for some marketing thing. One of those guys, it's like, I don't know what your major is. He had me text, I think it was either, it was a BYU game. And he had me text him updates like during his conference, like this is the score, this is what Jimmer has and things like that. So I definitely remember the Jimmer days.
Yeah. So, I mean, and so, you know, he's an elite level scorer, right? Mm. Elite level basketball player at BYU, scored tons and tons of points. So I read an interview with him one time because they were watching his warm up for a game and he only ever took shots from 3 different spots, right? He took like a shot from like the left side, 3-point, like mid range on the right, and then free throws. And they said, why are you only taking shots like from there during warmups? And he said, whenever I do film, I take 85% of my shots at these 3 spots. So I'm getting prepared for the game.
Wow.
But whenever I'm at practice, like I take shots from where I'm the least productive at. So I work on my weaknesses in practice. When I'm getting ready for the game, it's about my strengths. Mm. So I tell them that same thing. Like right now, this is practice, right? Like typically you're going to feed into your strengths. Like If I'm 6'2" and I'm playing soccer, all right, and I weigh 200 pounds and I'm going against a guy that's 5'5", I'm going to use my strength to beat this guy, right?
Right.
The body adapts and everybody has their own special unique gifts. So you want to maintain those strengths and maintain those gifts while still working on your weaknesses along the way. So
I like that yin and yang of strengths and weaknesses. I always try to figure out like a good philosophy for those because growing up in school, it was always about like work on your weaknesses, like stay balanced. Like you want to be good in every class. And then after I got out of grad school, it was like kind of like the Gary Vee mentality of like double down on your strengths, like do what you're good at, like relentlessly pursue what you're passionate about. But then if your weaknesses are too glaring or they're limiting your ceiling, you got to work on that too. So I think kind of that practice, and then now it's game time. These are the things that are my strengths. I think that is a wonderful philosophy for training and also for life, that you need to address both, but there's a time and place to put effort and intention into each of those to maximize the results and maximize for an athlete, like how they do in a game.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like there's a time and a place for everything, right? It goes back to what we talked about on Twitter. It's a time and a place for everything. It's just my job as a coach is to let everybody know, like, hey, there's a time and a place. Like, this right now is the time to work on your weaknesses, you know, and it can change from workout to workout. Like, hey, you already jump, you already have a 40-inch vertical, right? So when we do this power squat, I want you to actually focus more on force production because that's what you're good at, because we haven't focused on that within our training cycle or within this residual. So as long as we hit on this residual within our window, then you're going to be able to maintain that adaptation, and then we can continue to attack everything else.
And that's where having a coach who not only, like, you know, has played at a high level, but has worked with, you know, thousands of kids, thousands of athletes. It really helps to have them kind of dictate that flow of, hey, like, this is what we're working on, but today we need a little bit more of this, a little less of that. And I even see that in my own training. When I work out with friends or colleagues, or I talk to different coaches, it gets my mind in a better spot, because you can get so rigid in what you want to do. But when you have that outside influence, as both, you know, as an ageless athlete or as, you know, middle school, high school kid, it really helps foster development.
Yeah.
Well, wonderful. Thank you so much, Taylor, for jumping on. I always want to call you Tyler because of Tyler, Texas, but yeah. I appreciate you jumping on the podcast. It's been awesome to get to know you. I look forward to following you on social media, and keep lighting the world on fire, making a dent in the universe. And again, appreciate you, man.
Yeah, man. I appreciate you, Tom. Thanks for reaching out.